This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Campaigning group Shelter's latest figures, generally regarded as reliable, show that homelessness has risen rapidly in the last year. In England alone, there's been an increase of 14% in people housed in temporary accommodation. The figure stands at just under 280,000. We talk a lot about the problem of rough sleeping, rightly, but far less attention goes to this bigger and growing problem of homelessness, with all its consequences for individuals, families and communities. So why is homelessness on the rise in the UK? What are its drivers? And what might be done about it? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, let's take a look at those numbers. Michael Buchanan is the BBC's social affairs correspondent. Michael Buchanan, what do we mean when we talk about homelessness figures? Who are we talking about?
Well, the most visible form of homelessness is rough sleeping, and these are people that we see sleeping out on the streets of the UK. But in England, there are typically estimated to be about 3,000 rough sleepers per night, although most of the charities say that's a huge underestimation, but that's what the government's official data suggests. But the much bigger group of people who are classed as homeless are people living in temporary accommodation. And these are people who, in the most cases, have been living in the private sector. The landlord has asked them to leave for a variety of reasons, most often because the landlord wants to sell the property, asks the tenants to leave. The tenants look for somewhere else. They can't afford somewhere else, so they go to the local authority. And if the local authority deems that they have a duty to help them, then the local authority will help them to find other accommodation. And the latest data suggests that in England there are 105,000 households living in temporary accommodation. That's a record number of households. Shelter, the charity, have done some calculations and they think that that equates to around just under 280,000 people in England living in temporary accommodation. So I said a minute ago that there were 105,000 households in England in temporary accommodation. 60,000 of those are in London. It is a massive London problem. The London councils estimate that 1 in 50 Londoners are homeless. The borough of Newham has got the biggest problem, and they're estimated to have 1 in 20 of the residents being homeless. But it's not just an England problem. For instance, Glasgow and Edinburgh have both declared housing emergencies in the past couple of months.
What do we know about the ages, sex, etc. of the people who are in temporary accommodation?
Just under 140,000 of the people in temporary accommodation in England are children. The other main section that we know is because of the nature of the help that councils have to provide, the rest of them are mainly families, so mum and dad, disproportionately female as well, because typically, if you are a homeless, single man, the council has less of a responsibility to help you.
Now, what can we say about the trend in recent years?
So the trend in recent years has, in broad terms, gone up, both rough sleepers and people in temporary accommodation. The number of households in temporary accommodation is at record levels. It hasn't been anywhere close to this since around 2004, 2005. And the reasons that people say it's that the number of people is really high at the moment is a combination of reasons. One is that landlords are leaving the sector, so there are fewer properties. And secondly, one thing that's been largely blamed by lots of charities as well is a freeze to housing benefit levels. They've been frozen since April 2020. The think tank, the Institute for Fiscal Studies, did some calculations earlier on this year And it found that because rents were rising at the same time as benefits were frozen, then only one in 20 properties on a major commercial website would actually fall in within the housing benefit levels. It's worth pointing out the government have just announced that from next April they will increase those housing benefit levels. What's been happening in recent years is rents have gone up significantly. At the same time, you've had this benefit freeze, and that combination of that has led to people needing emergency housing. When we talk about temporary accommodation, that indicates that it's something that happens for a short period of time. Some people can end up living in temporary accommodation for years.
And that's not very temporary.
It's not very temporary at all. It effectively becomes the family home, but technically the council can ask somebody in temporary accommodation to move almost at the drop of a hat because they found them somewhere else or somewhere cheaper to go to.
Can we talk about what typically temporary accommodation is?
Typically it is a flat owned by a private landlord that is being paid by the council. So the council is paying the rent or a good chunk of the rent to the private landlord because the council will have relationships with various private landlords. For a small number of people, it's around 14,000 in England at the moment, households. They're living in bed and breakfast accommodation or in hotels. That literally means they're staying in places like Premier Inns and travel lodges, and they're spending weeks and weeks on end in there. They've got no cooking facilities. And it's also really, really temporary and uncertain. So, for instance, I know an hotel in North London that in the summer had to move people who were in temporary accommodation. They had to be moved out for about a week or 10 days because Beyoncé was playing in the capital. Guests had paid to stay in that hotel. So the people who were homeless were moved to hotels north of London until the Beyoncé concerts were over. And then these families were then moved back to London because the councils only spot purchased these hotels for a limited period of time.
Now, one obvious problem here is the potential knock-on effects. I imagine that if you're living in somewhere which is that temporary, and let's say you've got a family there, what are you going to do? Every time you move the children's school, you move your GP registration and so on?
The council will often just say to the family, we can put you up somewhere, but it's an hour's drive away or it's an hour on the train away from where you are, because that's the only place that we can find to put you at the moment. And that creates huge problems, in particular for schooling. Either the children have to change school, or quite often I've come across families who travel huge distances every morning on buses and public transport. Some of them drive to get their children to the school.
And presumably it also becomes a problem in keeping down jobs, because your travel distances might suddenly vary hugely.
Completely. And you end up with families going to extraordinary lengths in order to try and keep a job and keep their children in school. They're getting up at 4 or 5 in the morning in order to do all those various commutes and try and keep a semblance of a normal life.
Now, one of the things we also know about modern Britain is the record backlog of asylum seekers being processed and so on. Has there been an impact here on demand for temporary accommodation?
Yes. So the Home Office use a contractor in order to source accommodation for asylum seekers. And because this stock of properties has been diminishing, because one of the contributory factors is that landlords are leaving the sector, so they're selling up, what has happened in some parts of the country, particularly in London, is that you have got the Home Office contractor competing with London councils for the same properties. But the difference is that the London councils typically have a limit to how much they can spend on properties, whilst those limits do not apply to the Home Office contractor. So what you have ended up in some parts of the country is you have ended up with the Home Office contractor outbidding local councils for properties, which means that if the council can't find another property, they end up putting the family into an hotel.
What you're describing sounds a bit like a sort of perfect storm of different contributory factors coming together.
Yes. The way I like to look at it is that you have the Department for Work and Pensions trying to keep down the benefits bill. So they froze housing benefit, which meant that the Department for Housing had to pay last year £1.7 billion in order to help people with the consequences of homelessness. And then you get the Home Office coming in and sort of dropping a grenade into an incredibly tight market anyway by allowing its contractor to outbid councils for scarce accommodation.
Michael Buchanan. And just before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, which includes our episode on the Palestinian West Bank, the one on whether the government has any money left, and the one on assisted dying. Back to homelessness, and more specifically to the question of temporary accommodation. Let's go a bit deeper into what's driving the increase we're seeing. To help us do that, I'm joined by three specialists. Housing economist Professor Christine Whitehead from the LSE, Rachel Irica, senior economist at the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, and Matthew Wilkins from the Centre for Homelessness Impact, where he advises councils on tackling homelessness. Rachel Irica, we've heard from Michael Buchanan that a lot of the people who are presenting in temporary accommodation are on benefits. What's the problem here?
So local housing allowance is the rate at which we set the level for housing benefits in the UK for private renters. It is meant to cover the bottom 30th percentile of rents in your local area. When it was originally set up, it was meant to cover the bottom half of rents, now around the 30th percentile. At the moment, for new lets, so for example, if you're looking for a new private rental property, either because you've been evicted or you need to move, they currently cover between 4 and 5% on average of properties in an area. And in London, it's even worse because rents are simply so high and local housing allowances covering 1%, sometimes less. But unfortunately, decisions have been taken that have meant that local housing allowance has been frozen at the moment since April 2020. Now, renters up and down the country can tell you for certain that rents certainly haven't been frozen since April 2020. Those rent levels have just not been keeping pace at all with what has been happening in the private rented sector. We know that since those rent levels were set, private rents on average across the country have risen by over 30%. And what it means is that if you lose your home, you're then subject to having to find a new place to live with housing benefit that is completely inadequate.
How do other parts of the benefit system play into the problem?
The majority of people in receipt of benefits across the country will be receiving universal credit. And you would expect that it would be at a level sufficient to cover things like your food, your energy costs. But what we know is that it's falling far, far short of that. A single person living alone can receive around £85 a week in universal credit, but we've costed that you actually need £120 at an absolute minimum to be able to afford those essentials.
And is the situation with benefits more or less the same, and its interrelationship with housing, more or less the same outside England, in Wales, for example, and Scotland?
So the one thing that we have seen in Scotland is a real push on building social housing, which is very welcome, which reduces some of the pressure that we're seeing in the private rented sector. But in big cities like Edinburgh, you're still facing massive, massive constraints where housing benefits still can't keep up with the levels of rent that households are facing. So there's definitely issues across the whole of the UK. And when we're looking at whether or not benefits are sufficient to be able to meet people's costs, both across local housing allowance and universal credit, they're just simply not.
Matthew Wilkins, let's turn now to where the burden of this tends to lie with local authorities. Can you remind us what obligations local councils have towards the homeless?
Yeah, so local authorities across the UK, they have the statutory legal responsibility for working with people who are either at risk of homelessness or who are homeless. So basically, if you're at risk of homelessness, perhaps because a relationship is breaking down or because you're being threatened with eviction, you can approach your local authority and they will provide some kind of prevention support to you. And if you become homeless, they will then have a duty to provide you with some form of accommodation. I mean, that's basically across the UK. There are variations between different parts of the UK. So Scotland, for example, does not yet have prevention duty enshrined in law, although that's planned to be coming in quite soon. And then when you approach your local authority, there are various things they can do with you if you're if you need to have some prevention activity. And the type of support they will offer you, in England at least, there's a sort of priority system. So you're more likely to receive some form of temporary accommodation if, for example, you're in a vulnerable category or you have family or you're pregnant, for example.
Right. Now, let's look at the current situation. I'm going to ask you what's going to seem like a daft question in view of what's gone before, but are there enough places to put the people who are currently applying to local authorities for accommodation in?
There will be in some local authorities where you haven't seen a spike, but in those where you've seen a spike in demand, there simply isn't. So that's why we have record numbers of people in temporary accommodation, 105,000 households at the last count, which is the highest ever. And a really interesting sort of data reflection of this is that around 28% of people, perhaps more, who are placed into temporary accommodation are placed into temporary accommodation outside of their home local authority. It can be quite a long way away. And what we've also seen, reflecting the lack of options available, is a real increase in the use of bed and breakfast accommodation and an increase in the number of people, of households who are in temporary accommodation with children for a long period of time, which is against the law, by the way.
So councils are continuously in the business of searching for accommodation to put people in, both inside and outside, depending upon their needs, outside their own boundaries.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, let's talk about the suitability or unsuitability of such accommodation. Finding accommodation is one thing, I imagine. It being at all suitable for the type of people and the types of families you need to move there might be completely different. Can you talk about the problems that councils will have with finding suitable accommodation?
Well, if you go back to the first point we were discussing, which is around a legal responsibility, when somebody goes to a council, the council has a legal duty to house somebody. In many cases, what they provide people with will not be suitable. I think this goes back to the point I was making previously, that we've seen a real increase recently in the use of bed and breakfasts. And whenever you speak to a local authority, they acknowledge that this is sort of the least suitable accommodation, both in terms of cost, but other factors as well, such as safety and space requirements. You're likely to have shared facilities, the space will be restricted. The idea of being able to be there for a long period of time and have kids do homework, for example, whilst one's sleeping, it's quite inconceivable.
Right. Now, let's talk about why it's happening from the local authorities' point of view. We've heard that the benefit system might be encouraging one kind of problem, but from the point of view of the availability of accommodation, what's happening?
So local authorities for a long time would have had recourse. You know, if you go back through history, we had recourse to social housing. Obviously, there's less of that available now following the fact you've had right to buy for a number of years, and right to buy has not led to a sort of replacement of stock at the same levels. Now, for a long time, local authorities were able to respond to that sort of reduction in social housing stock through going to the private rented sector. But as we've heard, the private rented sector has increased in terms of rent levels far higher than housing benefits being able to catch up with it. In addition to that, what we've seen in recent years is not just that there's been an increase in rents, but there's been a sort of exit from the market of landlords. I think the numbers in London are something like 40% fewer properties available now than there were before the pandemic. And a further complication is that a lot of sort of providers who have sort of social housing on the tin, such as registered providers, what we used to call registered social landlords, would no longer work in a way that we'd necessarily regard as social. So all of the various options available to local authorities to house people have reduced gradually over a number of years, with the particular hits in the private rented sector recently.
How much does it cost councils to put people into temporary accommodation?
So for England, the total national figure we have, the most recent data is available for, is just over £1.7 billion a year spent on temporary accommodation. And that goes across all the different types, ranging from nightly lets through bed and breakfast up to, you know, long-term stays in the rented sector. One point worth noting, though, is that local authorities will often be able to recoup that back through housing benefits. So you have the interesting issue of one part of government paying out and then another paying back in as well.
Right, so, okay. So they're not bearing the entire cost.
Well, one point I would make is that you're able to claim back different amounts of housing benefit depending on the type of accommodation. And the more they use things such as bed and breakfast, where you can claim back a relatively low amount of housing benefit, the more cost they will bear. But one thing I would say is that we do a lot of work with local authorities, and a lot of them that we've been in various sizes recently, you've seen an escalation to the financial risk. In the past, adult social care, children's social care were the things that were really threatening them and their financial sustainability. But wherever we go now, we've heard of an increase in temporary accommodation costs being a threat to long-term financial sustainability.
Now, that's really interesting, because temporary accommodation is temporary accommodation, and you're talking about long-term problems. So somebody might ask, why, if it's temporary, is it a long-term problem?
I almost wish that we'd stop using the word temporary. So there will be, so I think there's 105,000 households in temporary accommodation approximately now. And some of them will move in quite quickly, move out quite quickly. However, we crunched some numbers and we figured that if you're in temporary accommodation in a London borough in the private rented sector, around half of those people will be there for around 5 years.
Finally, can we just touch upon the impact of homelessness amongst those granted refugee status, which has grown significantly, and obviously the backlog for those waiting to be processed is very great. What kind of knock-on has that had for local authorities?
So the emerging story that we're hearing at the moment is that there's been an acceleration of decision times by the Home Office, which is resulting people who then been asked to leave Home Office accommodation, who then require some form of temporary accommodation from a local authority, some of whom will be in priority need, others of whom will not and may end up rough sleeping. So that seems to be a significant additional pressure, which has been faced by a lot of urban local authorities over recent months.
Christine Whitehead, I now want to look at this question, which has been raised by just about everybody, actually, which is what has been happening in the private rented sector. Essentially, the picture is a significant drop in supply. Can you take us through the reasons why it's been happening?
Well, the first thing which is happening is people are staying a lot longer. So about a sixth of the apparent reduction is that people are staying twice as long as they were. So they're not coming onto the market again. Because the market has got very tight, particularly in London, people aren't going through formal ways of letting it out. So lots of people are just picking it up when their friend leaves and that sort of thing. So we don't actually know whether there is an enormous reduction in the supply. We know that there is an increase in sales, that is to say, landlords selling their properties. We don't know whether those properties are going into first-time buyer, not obviously, or into another landlord. So it's a complicated question.
Is it the case that landlords are moving out of the rental market, or is it the case that we simply don't know whether they are not, whether they're moving out of the rental market?
It's the second rather than the first. It is the case that a lot of landlords feel that the taxation changes have been hard on them, and that's one reason for going. But the core of the issue over the last year or so is simply that their costs are going up. A large number of buy-to-let mortgages are short-term fixed interest. So large numbers of landlords found themselves paying double in interest rate charges, that sort of thing, last year. And that is making a big difference. More interestingly, in some ways, across the country, 60% of landlords don't put the rent up for existing tenants. They'd only put it up when their tenancy changes. And that is changing rapidly because of these very high increases in interest rate charges and also in management, etc. But the other thing I think you do need to think about is that, you know, local authorities aren't in the top end of a market or even in the middle end of a market. They're in the bottom end of the market. They're trying to find cheap accommodation in wherever they can. And the result of that is that these are people who are much more distressed in terms of whether they're making money out of it than on average.
Now, let's talk about some other things which are thought to impact upon renters' willingness to rent out, particularly at the what we might call the lower end of the market, which is the question of protections for landlords or protections for tenants and reforms about that.
Yes, I mean, obviously the Rental Reform Bill did actually get to Parliament after some years, and it's now been told, the government has said that they will intend to legislate. What's in it is that a tenancy, instead of being basically a 1 year or possibly a 2 year tenancy, but with absolutely no right to stay if a landlord says, I want the property back, so I can go as a landlord and say, sorry, can you get out next month? And that will change to a different type of tenancy by which the tenant will be allowed to stay forever, while the landlord will only have, well, a number of reasons why they can get rid of the tenant, which will include the fact that they want to sell they won't be negligible, but it's a very, very different situation from just being able to say on Friday night, will you please leave at the end of a month? Now, they won't be able to legislate just like that, so there's plenty of time for landlords to get out later, but they're getting out now partly for that reason, partly for taxation reasons, and partly because a lot of them are quite old and may have got to the point where they want to realise some of their money.
Right, so all these things will are likely to have a depressing effect on whether or not low-cost rents are more freely available to people. Now, one final thing, Christine. I imagine that, as with the rest of what we've been discussing, this is incredibly different from one area to the other.
Yes, I mean, one of the things we really do need to say quite firmly is that, you know, London makes up roughly 60% of those in temporary accommodation. But the flow in is not very different from the rest of the country, 17% as opposed to 15% population. So what's happening is that in London, you simply cannot find any accommodation you can move into. So you're stuck in temporary accommodation for years and years in a way which isn't the case in other parts of the country. It's the case in some parts of the country. And it's not, for instance, the case in Wales, where the problem is much more of a family being able to afford what they need to rent.
I have a final question for each of you. If you don't mind, I'd like you to imagine that you've just got into the lift with the housing minister in the Department for Levelling Up, and also, sorry, it's me, and you've got 30 seconds to have your say. What one thing would each of you tell me would need to be done now to ease homelessness? Rachel?
The number one thing that I think we need to do across the UK is to increase the amount of social housing that we have available. Temporary accommodation is currently anything but temporary, with 6 and 10 staying for over a year. If we have more social rented accommodation across the country, that will absolutely help. But in addition to that, we have to make sure that our benefit system always covers the cost of essentials, that being a roof over your head, food on your table, being able to afford to shower every day and afford your toilet. It's not okay that in a country like ours, our social security system doesn't currently offer that service.
Bing, we've hit the first floor. Matthew, you've got until the second floor.
We need national governments across the UK to formulate plans and strategies to work with individual local authorities right now to help them deal with the pressures they're facing immediately, to give them the data they need and the sort of strategic insight they need to cope with the pressures they have more effectively.
And Christine?
We have just put out a proposal to do some more work on the costs of temporary accommodation, so maybe they will start to think about data more effectively. I think that really we want stability. We do not want a situation where we're saying we're going to put the rental reform bill through, we're going to put bits of it through, we're going to do the other. You've got to have there's a strategy about how you can use the existing stock better.
Christine Whitehead there with Rachel Irica and Matthew Wilkins. My thanks to them and to Michael Buchanan. And my conclusion at the end of all that is almost the usual one for this programme, which is that you need long-term solutions for long-term problems. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirstine Knight, Alex Lewis and Sophie Eastall. The sound engineer was Rod Farker and the editor is Richard Varden. If you celebrate Christmas, have a good one. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
To know what it means to be Roman, you need to look beyond the sweating gladiators. There are fresh stories to be told, from scattered clues and new discoveries. I'm Mary Beard, and I'll be uncovering these stories for Being Roman, a new series for BBC Radio 4. There's a young bride avenging the murder of her parents, and an emperor flirting outrageously with his nervous teacher. Listen to Being Roman wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.